Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Cannot believe it's Friday already. You know what? For me, it was one of those weeks where it just went slow, 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 boom, and then it went really fast. I guess it's like life. Well, maybe not. I don't know. We got a great show for you today. And the second hour, Carlo Broussard will be here, but we'll also have two contestants with us because we're going to do the game show, big game show, second hour. And I wrote the questions, so I think they're really good. We'll have to see. This hour, our good friend Joe Heschmeyer is here with us, and we're going to talk about the theological legacy, the theology of Pope John Paul II. Hello, Joe.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. Why today? Why do we want to talk about Pope John Paul II today?
Today is his feast day. Actually, it's a really provident timing. One of Anna, my wife's friends, just came in town and brought a JP2 blanket for our new baby and didn't even realize when she gave it to him that it was John Paul II's feast day.
Oh,
so
that's
happy
really
feast day
nice.
To JP2.
Not only that, I'm really happy to hear they're making JP2 baby blankets.
No. She had this specially designed. Like, it's way cooler than that.
Whoa.
I'll share pictures on Facebook. It's really
okay.
Good.
All right. So, John Paul, the longest serving pope of the modern era. I suppose that might not entirely be true because you might consider the 19th century the modern era. But,
right.
And there was I think it was Pio Nono, wasn't it? That was pope forever. I mean, for like half of.
I think that was Leo the 13th.
Oh, was it?
No, you're right. It was Pio Nono. 1846 to 1878. I just checked.
That's man. That's covering some territory there. But John Paul, the same. But then nobody calls Pope Pius the Great. They call John Paul the Great. Does that offend your sensibilities at all? That this man of our era is called the Great, where, you know, you got a Gregory the Great. You don't get too many the Greats.
No, it's more like because it's Gregory, it's Leo, it's John Paul II, and then Nicholas is the fourth one who's called the Great, and he's kind of a dark horse. You know, no one thinks of him today, but once upon a time, people thought a great deal of him.
Yeah.
So yeah, it doesn't offend my sensibilities at all. I think JP2's legacy in terms of guiding the church, but especially in terms of philosophy and theology, has been massive. And it's mm-hmm. hard to conceptualize kind of the field of Catholic theology before and after him, and how different kind of I think his lasting legacy in areas like theology of the body and other areas has been. Yeah. And I think it will continue to be. I think 100 years from now, it'll still matter. Kind of what he said, what he taught, in a way that isn't always true of you know, papal actions.
I'm glad you said that because I was going to hang up on you if you said that bothered you that he was called the Great. One of the things that everyone who gets the Great after their name shares in common is that the times they lived in were a mess. So he did have a lot of messes to clean up when he became pope.
Yeah, I mean, you've got messes inside the church, but you also have the external threats the church is facing. So, yeah. You know, in the past, it might have been like the Mongols or the Huns. Well, here it was communism. And, you know, anyone familiar with John Paul II's life knows that he grew up, was pretty quickly an orphan, then dealt with Nazis, then dealt with communists. And Poland had this very long and very tragic history of oppression, and he lived through a good deal of that. And so he came to the papacy with a real realism, I guess I would say, a sense of the awfulness of communism. And I think he was really instrumental in mobilizing the spiritual forces of the church to stand up to the horrors of what he'd seen in the Eastern Bloc.
It strikes me, however, that today one of the things that I think a lot of kind of Catholic apologists and apologetic type institutions didn't expect, but and maybe you did, Joe. I don't know. I'm not. Maybe you're the exception here. But just how much in the 2020s we would be defending the Second Vatican Council, where I literally have young people come up to me after a talk. They're 19, 20 years old, and they go, "What do you think of the Second Vatican Council? Was it good or bad?" And that kind of reevaluation that's going on about the Second Vatican Council, I think it also affects the people's understanding of Pope John Paul II. I think people are much more willing to be critical of him now, or there's just much more criticism of him now than there was 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, I think you have a few things. One, I mean, you have the whole pastoral dimension. He was not the best at choosing clerics. He was not the best at choosing bishops and choosing cardinals. And I think time has not always been on his side in terms of some of his choices. Cardinal McCarrick was obviously a disaster. There are many others who, you know, might be more controversial for me to name publicly. But, you know, a lot of when you look at bad actors in the church who are maybe voices for bad ideas, a lot of them kind of got to where they were because, you know, a papal nuncio suggested them to John Paul II and he gave the okay. That's a complicated history. And I think because of it, justifiably, people have voiced a lot of criticisms.
Yeah, that's one something of the reasons that, that over time shows itself more and more.
Exactly. At the time, it's hard to know if this kind of rising star is good or bad. Right. And he backed a lot of bad horses, so to speak. But the other thing is, so from even from his name, right? So he's John Paul II. So let's just break that down. Well, John Paul I was his immediate predecessor. He only reigned for 33 days from August 22nd to September 28th of 1978. And he took the name John Paul in honor of Pope John the 23rd, who began the Second Vatican Council, and Paul VI, who concluded it. So he wanted his pontificate to be understood as sort of that of the Pope who would implement Vatican II, but then he dies 33 days later, and that task falls to Karol Wojtyła, who takes up the mantle symbolically by taking the name John Paul for himself, that he kind of understands his own role as being the one who's going to be in charge of implementing this big, transformative, messy kind of council.
And it was a task he was up to, though. But things that were controversial at the beginning of his papacy, in many cases, were resolved by the end of the papacy. Certainly not everything. But what would you say would be, and I do want people to feel free to call and talk with Joe about the theological legacy, the theology. And we're kind of sticking to the theology that, because you just can't. I mean, he is one of the towering figures of our age or any age. And so you can't get to all the aspects. So we thought we'd talk about the theology today. If you want to talk about that, 888-318-7884. You don't have to be a theologian. If you just want to talk about, I didn't agree with him on this, or I loved him because of that, 888-318-7884. But now I totally forgot my question. Do you know where I was going, Joe?
I think you were going to ask about major contributions he made theologically.
The major themes. Major themes. That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah, thank you. You're a good mind reader.
You set it up pretty well. So I think major themes for him. One is really stressing Marian devotion. Now, to Catholics who are, you know, my age or younger, it might seem like kind of a no-brainer that Catholics, of course, we're really into Mary. We love Mary. But at the time, like there are stories of seminaries like actively discouraging seminarians from praying the rosary,
right,
and viewing that as just like an obstacle to ecumenism, viewing that as like an outdated tradition. And JP II, for all of his brilliance, has the simple, humble faith of a Polish layman. You know, this is how he grew up. This is, you know, he had this love of Mary. That love is deepened and not eradicated with his love of philosophy and theology. And so he writes a whole lot about Mary. He writes a whole lot about the rosary. And that's an important fight that he's taking. It's easy to take those and just think, oh, this is just devotional. Like, he's just saying, say your prayers, kids. But no, like, understand that this was an actual fight, that there were people in the church who thought we're talking about Mary too much, and that he's really going to bat to say, no, it's important as Catholics we understand the role of Mary theologically and that we have this constant recourse to her spiritually. That's a big fight. That's a really important fight, and he spends a lot of time and effort on it. Second, a major theme is that of ecumenism, that he wasn't just saying, well, we're going to stick with the way we've always done things and forget about you guys to Protestants or to the rest of the world. That there's this real sense in which I think he understood, especially as someone who grew up in Poland, that Christians everywhere, and even in a certain sense, religious people everywhere, have to stand up against the forces of secularism, atheism, communism, and the rest. That there really was a fight that Catholics were part of, but we had allies in that fight among people that we'd had some pretty serious disagreements in the past, people with whom we still have serious disagreements. You know, like Catholics and Protestants, we disagree on a lot of important things, but if someone comes along and says Jesus isn't Lord, we need to put those things aside for a second and say, yes, he is, and we agree on that. You know, that sort of thing. So you see a lot on ecumenism. He also has some really important contributions on human sexuality and related stuff. His so-called theology of the body is a masterful unpacking of Genesis 1 to 3 and a masterful kind of vision of the human person. And then a fourth area I would point out, I'm going to give five. So a fourth would be the Eucharist. He has a tremendous love of the Eucharist. His very last encyclical, Ecclesia de Eucharistia, the Church of the Eucharist, does a lot in focusing on the Eucharist and its role in the life of the church. And then finally, I think an area that we don't talk about him enough is that he really does great work on the theology of suffering. That he has this document called Salvici Doloris, where he just looks at what's the point of human suffering. Now, this is someone who, as I've already mentioned, you know, experienced tremendous suffering at the loss of his parents, but also the kind of broader suffering of seeing everyone around. You know, he had a Jewish best friend growing up at a time when things were not going well for the Jews in Poland and in Europe more broadly.
How are you for understatement there, Joe?
Yes.
At a time when things were not going well.
Yes, I mean, I don't want to spoil Schindler's List or anything for anyone who hasn't watched a thousand movies.
In other words, during the Holocaust.
Yes, during the Holocaust. And I even mean before that.
Okay.
Things were going very badly that led up to, it isn't like the Holocaust came out of nowhere. It's like there is some very fervent anti-Jewish sentiment, often from Christians, often from Catholics specifically, in places like Poland and places like Germany throughout Europe that reaches a horrible kind of crescendo. He sees the worst chapter of that directly, up close.
Right.
And then afterwards, you know, sees the horrors of communism, that they were in many ways out of the frying pan and into the fires. And so he sees all of that and is able to not lose his faith in that, but is able to search in a more meaningful way to say, why does suffering exist? What is this all about? And he has some pretty profound answers. I would really recommend Salvici Doloris to anyone who may be grappling with that. Now, there's a lot of other stuff that he does. I could have mentioned five other major theological areas. He's called the great for a reason. But I think that's a good maybe starting place.
Our number is 888-318-7884. You don't have to agree with us on Pope John Paul II. You don't have to be Catholic even to call. We're talking about the theology of Pope John Paul II this hour on his feast day. The number 888-318-7884. You're welcome to bring a comment today, or if you've got a question is welcome as well. 888-318-7884. Right back with more Joe Heschmeyer on John Paul the Great.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Imagine a career bringing the eternal word to millions around the globe. At EWTN, we're committed to spreading the gospel from a Catholic perspective, touching millions via television, radio, publishing, and the internet. Right now, EWTN is looking for qualified people to fill a number of exciting positions. Make a difference using your God-given talent. Visit EWTN.com/employment today. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest today. And Joe's talking about the theology of John Paul II. This is his feast day. And why does he have a feast day? Because he's a saint. I don't even know if we mentioned that. That's pretty good when you're such an impressive guy that it takes till segment two to get around to mentioning that you're a saint. you can call with your questions or comments about the theology of Pope John Paul II, 888-318-7884. You're welcome if you agree with us. You're welcome if you disagree. 888-318-7884. If I may, Joe, before I go to the calls, you gave us five areas of where he was tremendously influential as a theologian. I wonder if you could just kind of go give us the personal for you. What do you find? Because I know this to be the case, that you find him to be a very attractive and person theologically. For you personally, what draws you to the theology of Pope John Paul II?
So at different stages in my life, it's been different aspects. I think he took a strong stand against some of the more, shall we say, modernist forces in the church and stood up to them. I think his nuanced treatment of liberation theology was really good and really important. In college, that was really important for me. Liberation theology, to oversimplify things a little bit, is an attempt to combine the gospel with Marxism. And as like a young college student, it seemed like, well, good, like people are really caring about the poor. But there's an instruction on a theology of liberation that Cardinal Ratzinger wrote under the guidance of John Paul II that gives a good kind of nuanced critique, maybe even I might say takedown of some of the theological errors. So that was really important at one point in my life. Veritatis Splendor, where he talks about the splendor of the truth and stands up to certain really widespread theological errors in Catholic theology. That was really important. Fides et Ratio, where he just defends the idea that faith and reason belong together. That was really helpful for me in kind of getting through some, how do we make sense of these two things? This notion that faith and reason are the two wings on which the human spirit rises is a really important idea. Embedded in there too, and actually in the very first section, I think even the first paragraph, is this idea that we only come to know ourselves by coming to know God. And that's been a major theme for me personally and in some of the stuff that I've written. I have the book, Who Am I, Lord? Finding Your Identity in Christ. It's very much built on that kind of idea. And then finally, he has what's called a meditation on givenness. And it's this idea that men and women are made for each other, even outside the specific context of marriage. And so he says, even like as a priest, there may be some role that you have in kind of helping a woman to recognize her own unique feminine beauty and genius. And what he's describing there, this sexed but not sexual interaction, is really beautiful and profound. And I would even say very daring for a Catholic priest, much less a pope, to kind of publicly kind of call for, because you can see 1,000 ways it could go wrong. But it's also really important in sort of reclaiming something about men and women as people. And certainly as a father to a daughter, the way that I'm called to praise my daughter's beauty and femininity in a different way than my wife can is really just like profound. And I think it's constantly being unpacked.
We're talking about the theology of Pope John Paul II. Lots of folks on the line. We want to get to anything else before we go to calls, or shall we go to calls?
No, let's go to calls.
It's the feast day of Saint Pope. This is another thing that he left us with. I mean, you have to say a lot of words to identify him now. Pope John Paul II, the great saint, or Saint John Paul, Pope II, great. It's very hard. That's why I think so many people just say JP2, which I find, you young whippersnapper saying JP2, so disrespectful. But, I mean, he did put us in that position by, is that what it says behind you, JP2?
My license plate literally says JP2. So, but the other license plate we have says Wetiwa. So I'm not sure if you find one more or less respectful.
All right, let's go to Vela in New Jersey, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Vela, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your comment or question for Joe.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to share an experience I had with St. John Paul II because it was, I was at the time, this experience I had 2 weeks after he passed away. I had a miscarriage, and that had been in February. And I was just praying. I was not back in the church. I was Catholic, but not back in the church. And I'd pray. And somehow, 2 weeks after he passed away, in the dream, this is me in the dream, I just saw his image just come to me and just say, you're going to have a child. I just remember this, and this is 15 years ago. 16, because my daughter's 15, so it's 16.
Yeah.
And I conceived my daughter the following week, the 30th
wow.
of April.
Isn't that a beautiful story, Bella? That's
and
a beautiful story.
My daughter's 15. She was born in January 18. And throughout my pregnancy, they say, well, she's Down syndrome, she's this, she's that. And I said, no. She doesn't have anything because a saint would not come to me and tell me that I was going to have a child. So, and even today, right now, my daughter's having a struggle with LGBT and everything. And I said, that's okay. You know why? Because a saint said she was going to be here. There's a reason why. And I tell my daughter the story. I said, I don't care what you're going through. You'll become a force in this church. And what you're going through right now is to prepare you for the trouble, the things that can come upon you. Yeah. That's okay. Don't worry. You have a powerful saint.
I like that last part. Bella, thanks. Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's like everything about that was just classic Catholic mom, down to the I. I think every mom listening in hopefully resonated with that. But no, there's something really beautiful about that and something so specific to John Paul II. You know, he has the encyclical Evangelium Vitae, which is on the gospel of life. And he begins it by saying that the gospel of life is at the heart of Jesus's message. Lovingly received day after day by the church, it is to be preached with dauntless fidelity as good news to the people of every age and culture. And he points out that, like, the Christian message begins with the good news of the birth of a baby. And so it's very fitting that it was John Paul II who appeared to you in a dream and said, you're going to have a baby, because that's the thing that he got is, like, this central part of Christianity, that we're living in this world in which babies are not always received as good news. That, like, to hear you're going to be pregnant or you are pregnant, you're going to have a baby, is not something people always rejoice at. But that there's this profound way in which Christianity reveals that every child is good news, because human life is worth fighting for, it's worth defending. There is what he calls the incomparable worth of the human person, that God wants you as you, that you're created for your own sake. And that therefore, like, we should join in with the rest of creation in rejoicing that you exist. It's why, like, birthdays are actually really good news. I was talking with a former Jehovah's Witness recently who didn't get why birthdays existed, thought they were too kind of narcissistic. But no, a birthday is a yes to reality. It's a yes to existence. It's a yes to creation. And in that way, it really, properly understood, is praise of God and the goodness for which he is, you know, filled the world.
I love praising God by eating cake, too. It's a great combination. Bella, thanks very, very much. I'm sure there are many, many people who have similar stories about John Paul. The stories that people will tell about the time that they met him or what their interactions were like when he was on this earth are extraordinary. He had a really kind of clever sense of humor, is the sense that I get. So many people that met him, there was a funny little line or something that they remember from him, which is a very humanizing thing. I think he humanized the moments that people had encounters with him. Bella, again, thanks. Thanks very, very much. Just
in terms of those humanizing moments, if I may share one, there was a, I don't know if it was a bishop or a priest of the Diocese of Bismarck, had multiple times met Pope John Paul II and said every time he met him and said he was from Bismarck, JP2 would kind of go, ah, Otto von Bismarck, he's not a good man for the church. And finally, this priest had heard this enough times that just said, you said that last time, Holy Father, and kind of like snapped on behalf of his diocese. I thought that was just such a funny story of the humanity of kind of both people involved.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Ethan in Cincinnati, you're up next. Ethan, watching on YouTube, go ahead with your question or comment for Joe about John Paul II.
So my thoughts are, hello.
Hello,
Joe Heschmeyer. God bless.
Hi.
And Psych Helmet.
Me too. Thank you.
One thing I would like to say is, like, how likely do you think it will be in the future that John Paul II will be declared a doctor of the church?
Ooh. Okay, so for those who don't know what a doctor of the church is, we just had the announcement that there is a newly about to be named doctor of the church, St. Irenaeus of Lyon. And doctor here does not mean like medical doctor. It's the original sense of the word doctor, which meant teacher. So the doctors of the church are the handful of great saints who were particularly important in presenting the faith in some way or teaching it in some way where they maybe gave a new perspective or offered some new insight. The big ones are people like Augustine, but you also have later people like Aquinas. And even some more recent ones, Thérèse of Lisieux is a great example of a more modern doctor of the church. And I think he richly deserves the title. But, you know, in a lot of ways, like, there's some brilliant theologian saints. But with things like theology of the body, you see a particular, like, John Paul II angle through which he approaches theology and reality that has been really influential. And those are kind of the hallmarks of a doctor, someone who's very holy, and gives us a helpful new way of looking at what we've always believed.
All right, Ethan, thanks very much. Like he needs another title. We'll be right back with more on Pope John Paul II on his feast day.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer. Second hour, hey, we're going to do the game show. No, I can't say what I was about to say. I was going to give away a little bit about what the game show is about, but I can't do that. That would be wrong. But Carlo Broussard's going to be here, and it's a whole lot of fun. And you can test yourself. You can test the kids. You can even test Grandma and Grandpa. The whole family can get together and take the game show quiz with us via the radio waves. Joe, we're talking a bit about Pope John Paul II today on his feast day. The reason he has a feast day is he is a saint of the Catholic Church, Santo Subito. Do you know what that means? I know I'm very advanced in my Italian, but I don't know.
It was so something the crowds were chanting after he died. They were in Rome chanting for his sainthood to happen, you know, right away. It was
make him
just
a saint
urging
now.
The church. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And
which basically happened. I mean, it's an incredible turnaround time for him to be declared a saint that quickly. Not the fastest. I think that goes to Saint Peter Martyr, but it was one of the fastest.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know. I'm not really in the let's canonize people 5 years after they're dead camp. This is something that, but I mean, come on. Pope John Paul.
I think it was providential, honestly.
Do you?
Because there have been a lot of controversies about him after the fact.
Oh, I see.
And so to be able to have the framework to know infallibly for all of the mistakes he made, this man is a great saint in heaven.
Yeah.
It helps us be able to have an adult conversation about his shortcomings and faults
without
it being like, you know, one extreme or the other. Either he made no mistakes or because he made mistakes, he's not in heaven.
Right.
Which is sometimes the kind of Pollyannish and incorrect view of saints that we can take.
Yeah. If you don't get stuff wrong, I mean, if getting stuff wrong keeps you out of heaven, the only Jesus and Mary are there. Nobody, everybody else gets stuff wrong. I mean, and sometimes in grave, we have wonderful saints who we would not approve of some of their behavior today because the moral calculations are different.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, saints who made tremendous mistakes, even reading the lives of the church fathers, some of the machinations, even kind of the politics, so to speak, and especially the Eastern Church, it was messy sometimes. And so they were in situations where it was like, well, I don't know if that was the right decision, but I don't want to be held up by that same kind of standard myself. I mean, JP2 was a pope for like 26 years. Do you want someone to comb through the last 26 years of your life and say, well, here are all the mistakes that you made that you never publicly apologized for? No one could pass that threshold, excluding, you know, members of the Holy Family.
Right. Yeah. I would prefer the last 26 to the first 26. If it comes to anybody has to do an evaluation, I'm hoping. I mean, I don't know all that will happen in the last 26, but I feel like some improvements have been made.
I see. My problem is a lot of my last 26 overlaps with my first 26. So I'm still young enough that my last 26 are
not me.
A little hairier.
Let's go to Daphne in Morgantown, West Virginia, listening on EWTN. Daphne, we're happy to have you. You want to talk about Pope John Paul II?
I do. Just wanted to share a little story that almost 14 years ago, I was expecting my first child at the age of 43. And of course, I was an older mom and, you know, very concerned about the safety of the baby and several other things. And I asked St. John Paul II to bless and protect her and, you know, let her do great things for, you know, for our Lord. And as a result of that, I delivered a wonderful daughter named Anna, who's now in middle school and almost 14 years old. And today I went to Mass after work, which usually I don't have the opportunity to do, and to pray for her because she's having, you know, some middle school growing pain kind of things going on. And to pray for her and to pray for me as her mother, and found that it was St. John Paul II's feast day, which I thought was so profound. And, you know, when y'all were talking about how St. John Paul had the devotion to the Blessed Mother, it reminded me that when Anna was very young, you know, like preschool age, we were talking about the Blessed Mother. And she said, Mama, I know the Blessed Mother. And I said, that's awesome. And she said, no, really, I know the Blessed Mother, in her, you know, whatever word she used for that age. And I said, oh, and she said, yes, she was with me. And I said, where was she with you, Anna? And she said, in your tummy.
Oh,
and I did have, you know, actually a dangerous you know, labor situation where I had to be, I had to have an emergency C-section, and my mom and I were praying the rosary before that. So I wondered, I was like, well, maybe.
Yeah. It all sounds so consistent with
story.
With St. John Paul II too. I mean, the Marian devotion and the utter commitment in love to the care for the unborn. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I think those two things that you just highlighted are exactly right and belong together. You know, occasionally you'll find Catholics who call themselves pro-choice. And besides just being against the teachings of the church, it also goes so much against what Scripture lays out. Like, the first person to really praise Jesus is unborn John the Baptist in the womb of Elizabeth. When the Virgin Mary goes in the visitation in Luke 1, Jesus is still under a month old at this point. So she arises and goes with haste. And meanwhile, John is 6 months older, but he's still in the second or maybe early third trimester of pregnancy. That there is this recognition that from the earliest moments, there is life in the womb, and it is human life, and it is human life worth rejoicing in. Now, obviously, that's true in a special way when it's the unborn Jesus Christ. But the point that John Paul II makes is this is true of all human life, that every unborn child is worth rejoicing over. He says, I mentioned Evangelium Vitae earlier. In paragraph 5 of that, he talks about how there exists a great multitude of weak and defenseless human beings, unborn children in particular, whose fundamental right to life is being trampled upon. And his point is that just as the church has to stand up for example, laborers and immigrants and all of these other groups who are downtrodden, who are oppressed, no less do we need to stand up against this new form of social injustice that's just categorized this whole class of human beings as being less than fully human. That every time that happens, it's an affront to humanity, but it's also an affront to the gospel. And so John Paul II stands strong on that. And so you see that theological profundity combined with a sort of toughness that he has as Pope, combined with a sort of gentleness and just a very particular love for babies and the unborn and for the Virgin Mary. And I think that comes out really beautifully. And now two stories of how he's kind of interceded for these unborn children.
Yeah, if I'm learning anything from today's show, it's that pregnant women should pray to John Paul II, because he seems to be very helpful. He's two out of our three calls so far. Let's go to more phone calls. Daphne, God bless you. Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful story. Let's go to Walt in Philly, listening on TuneIn Radio. Walt, you there with us?
I am.
All right, go ahead.
I think he was a very good pope overall. And we actually have a son named John Paul. We named after him. Yes. But I think the meetings at Assisi are sort of very problematic in that in a poorly catechized Catholic culture after Vatican Council II, can't blame the council. It's just the way it was, the way they so-called implemented it. It led to religious indifferentism. Doesn't matter what religion you are as long as you believe in God. That kind of thing. So I think that's one of the main difficulties that young people are, who are serious about their faith, like especially my own sons, say, well, that was really a mistake that he did that, because it just made people think that it doesn't matter what religion you are as long as you believe in something.
Joe, what do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it was a major, a really lamentable misstep. So for those who aren't familiar, John Paul II invited world religious leaders to come to Assisi, which is, you know, where St. Francis of Assisi starts the Franciscans and has this reputation of being a real city of peace. The Franciscans have a giant church there that has Pax, you know, Latin for peace, as like the hedge garden. It's a beautiful, very serene kind of environment. And he gathered them all together to pray for peace, for world peace, which is not a bad thing, but they were praying in these Catholic churches. So you had these, you know, sometimes like pagan worship ceremonies that are questionable whether they're worshiping God or demons or other. In Catholic churches. And so there is an aspect of both religious indifferentism. I might even go further and say it kind of invites desecration of churches, even if that's not the goal. Like, it's good to say, hey, pray for me to other people. It's best, of course, with other Christians, but we don't deny the possibility that someone who doesn't have a full understanding of the gospel might still have prayers that are very good and are heard by God, even if the person doesn't know how to address him properly. And praying for world peace is a really good thing. There's a tremendous spiritual energy being mobilized here to fight for peace at a time when things like nuclear war seemed like a very real possibility. So I get the good intention behind it. And I think that there were ways that it could have been done that wouldn't have led to religious indifferentism and wouldn't have led to kind of the risk of, you know, desecration of churches I think the way it was done was very much a mistake. And I think even Cardinal Ratzinger made it pretty clear afterwards that he thought this was not the Pope's finest moment, that he could have done a lot of things differently. And I think it wouldn't be something that'd be repeated in the same way. In fact, after the first one, they made some big changes to kind of how they approached these sort of interreligious gatherings.
What do you think, Walt?
Yeah, I think that's good. Unfortunately, with the Amazon Synod, we sort of had a repeat of that kind of stuff. So let's hope and pray that our popes get a little more smarter about that stuff, because we have a very poorly catechized. I'm a catechist. We have a very poorly catechized Catholic population who, from the 50s on down, and they just don't know their faith, and it just leads to confusion, religious indifferentism, syncretism, and all those other things that are contrary to authentic evangelization.
Walt, thanks. I have to go to the break, Joe. But I would say that while I do not at all deny the poverty of catechesis, you know who's not poorly catechized? People who listen to Catholic radio. Like, really, seriously. I think it's making up for a long period of poor catechesis. The Catholic radio and some of the other Catholic media that have grown up are providing an antidote to some of that. And you know what? Catholic radio in the United States, you know when it exploded? Right after John Paul II came to Denver, and he said to the Catholics there, one of the things he said was, you're not using the media properly to evangelize. And then the next year, 1997, a bunch of Catholic radio stations opened, and they've been opening more every year since. So not a lot of people know that story. We got to take a break, though. We'll be right back with more with Joe Eschmeyer on the theology of Pope John Paul II.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
I'm Kimberly Hahn, and my new show, Beloved and Blessed, is now on EWTN Radio. Every week, I share scripture and my personal experience to speak to the desires and strengths of all women so that each of us can better live out our vocations as daughters of God. Tune in to find inspiration, hope, and strength in each episode.
Don't miss Beloved and Blessed with Kimberly Hahn, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, only on EWTN Radio.
A lot of great calls this hour on the feast of Pope John Paul II. We're talking about the theology of Pope John Paul II, and as much as they are great calls, only one call really on the theology of Pope John Paul II, and it's quite critical of his theology. That is the decision to engage in that first big prayer for peace in Assisi. It did have, while I don't disagree with your analysis, Joe, it also did have good qualities to it. I mean, there was a sense that the presentation of the Catholic Church as the face of desiring peace in a time where they're just, as you said, much like our day. I think people have forgotten this, but even more so in a more pressing way, there was a daily fear of nuclear war. It wasn't a total failure.
No, it wasn't. And I think you're highlighting something really important that is worth kind of chewing on. Like, when the religions of the world want to be united on anything, even as simple as like peace is good and worth fighting for, who has to spearhead it? Well, the Catholic Church. Likewise, when we talk about like ecumenical dialogue, which is to say like between Christian churches and denominations, you see this real sense that if there's a single person who can speak on behalf of Christianity alive today, it's the Pope. That even Protestants kind of get that in a way that Catholics often don't. That even, non-Catholics, Orthodox, non-denominational, whatever, that there's often this sense that, like, the Catholic Church in general, and the Pope in particular, has this unique sort of leadership among Christians, particularly even among religious people, you know, that "What If God Was One of Us" song, you know, Jesus goes back to heaven, no one calls him on the phone except maybe the Pope down in Rome. There's like,
yeah,
even
one guy
who aren't religious
is still
at
interested
all.
In Jesus. Yeah. It's the Pope.
Right. Yeah. And he just, because he's got a call, he can call him directly. That sort of idea, maybe we take that for granted as Catholics, but there's actually something very profound about that. And maybe it would make more sense to imagine for a minute the tables were turned, and that when everyone wanted to talk about religion around the world, they always thought of Buddhism or Islam or whatever. They always thought of, you know, some important leader within those religions. But they don't, and I would venture that most people couldn't name, you know, a prominent Sunni or Shia or Buddhist, you know, whereas even non-Christians know who the head of the Catholic Church is. They know who the Pope is, not just in historically Christian countries like the U.S., but around the world. And that's an important way in which, in marshaling those interreligious dialogues and ecumenical stuff, the Pope is trying to use his authority. And it is an important reminder, like, if you take religion seriously, and in particular, if you take Christianity seriously, the Pope's a force to be contended with. You have to take him seriously as well. Uh-huh.
Right. And he wasn't afraid at all of that contention. But what you just said reminds me of the what Lenny Bruce used to say, the comedian.
I know the line.
You
used to
say,
there are many churches, there's only one, the church.
Yeah. When people say the church, everybody knows what they're talking about. Okay. So I do want to say something about his theology and ask you about it myself. And that is that as great a theologian as he was, and often I found his writing a bit difficult and circular, and also to add two more modifiers, difficult and circular. But he had this ability to also distill theology and theological concepts beautifully. And I want to give you an example of that. Cardinal Bernardine in Chicago came up with this idea of the seamless garment. And it's not a bad idea. It's not an evil idea. He's not an evil man for coming up with it. It's a pro-life idea. But it doesn't quite work because it tends towards a kind of leveling of all of the evils that can be committed against human dignity and human life as if they are all equal. And at the same time, roughly speaking, historically, Pope John Paul comes up with this phrase, the culture of life. And you don't hear much about the seamless garment anymore because it's obvious that the culture of life is the more, it's every bit as pithy. It's every bit as just, it's all it is a slogan, but it's much more theologically prudent.
Yes, I think it neatly it captures the good Cardinal Bernardine was trying to capture, and avoids the evils or the problems that his formulation had. Because his formulation, as you suggest, it's a continual, a seamless garment. So there's this sense that, well, you know, workers' rights is a pro-life issue. Euthanasia is a pro-life issue. The death penalty is a pro-life issue. Abortion is a pro-life issue. And so in real practical terms, this meant that when voters would look at the landscape, they would say, well, no one meets all of these things perfectly that I can vote for. Or if there is someone, they're in this obscure party no one's ever heard of. And so it led to this sort of kind of indifferentism. This idea, well, you know, he's not great on workers' rights. This guy's not great on abortion, potato, potato, with no sense that like one of those things might be more morally grievous than the other. John Paul II manages to capture the importance of both issues, that we have to care about both. We have to care about all of these issues and that they're not all equally important. They're not all equally grave. You know, so there's a pretty big difference there. So I think, yeah, like you said, culture of life just captures something that the seamless garment doesn't.
We're talking about Pope John Paul II. We're talking about his theological legacy, his great contribution as a theologian. I think it would be a bit remiss to talk about the theology of John Paul II without talking about the fact that he could spot theological talent when he saw it too. and that you know what I'm about to, whose name I'm about to give you?
Well, I assume you mean his successor.
Yeah, Pope Benedict XVI, who he never would let
home. That successor. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You know, people are often like, why do you think Benedict resigned? And partly it's just because no one could stop him this time.
Yeah.
He tried to resign resign as cardinal three times.
Yeah.
And the guy, he constantly had like a resignation letter ready, I think. And the Pope was just like, no, you can't leave. You can't go home. You have to stay in Italy.
Right. And it's one of the great partnerships in the history of the Catholic faith.
Seriously, because John Paul II has this movie star kind of charisma. You know, he was an actor. He had this real charm to him and was very gentle and very loving and affirming. But as you said, he was not always the most succinct. He would wax poetic about things. You know, he has that poetic sort of soul. Ratzinger would just kind of cut to the quick and say, you know, here's why you're wrong, though. And so the two of them together, I think, were a lot more effective than either of them separately. And I would say, even in point of fact, like, I love Pope Benedict, but I think without having someone to balance him, a lot of people kind of wrote him off as being too curmudgeonly and just kind of ignored the brilliant things that he was saying.
So you're saying that John Paul II tempered Joseph Ratzinger in a way
I think the two of them worked well together. And the liberation theology thing that I mentioned earlier, the instruction that he wrote as the head of the CDF, when he submitted it to the Pope said, you haven't said enough about the things that is getting right. You haven't said enough about the good things that are drawing people to it, and had him write a chapter basically acknowledging, I get why you want to go this way and why that's like drawing your heart in this direction. And I'll tell you, it makes the document a lot more effective. It doesn't just say, here's why you're wrong. It says, good, the good you're trying to do, taking care of the poor, is good. It's beautiful. And it's good that you notice things like Christ feeds the masses before he preaches to them. But man does not live by bread alone. And so it's not adequate to subordinate the gospel to purely material ends. Ah. It ends up being a lot more effective when you can both validate what they are getting right, even if it's just at the level of good intentions, and then you raise the critique. So I think Ratzinger learned a lot from JP2, and I think he provided a lot as well. They are a beautiful pair.
Yeah, really, really. And I think people will be studying that relationship as long as there's still a church, which will be, by the way, forever. Let's go to John. I don't have a location for John, but we're glad you're here, John. Go ahead with your comment or question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yeah, hi. My comment was, I always appreciated Pope John Paul and the fact that he really enforced the idea of the sanctity of the family, that divorce was not an option, that life is paramount. And I think those values transcended across not just Catholics, but a lot of Protestants too, where sometimes in our Protestant church, we don't shout that out strong enough, as often enough.
Oh, so you're a Protestant yourself, John?
Yeah, I go to Hope Lutheran Missouri Synod, and I mean, we're very, very close cousins. I mean, we believe in the true divinity of Christ in the Eucharist. But still, I listen to EWTN all the time, and I have followed the teachings of the Catholic Church quite long time, and I enjoy the radio very, very much.
I've only got a minute left, so I'm going to let Joe give a response, but I'm sure you are not the only Protestant Christian in the world who thought John Paul was very helpful in those regards.
Yeah, amen. I think that's brilliant. And if you want more on that, there's an apostolic exhortation John Paul II wrote called Familiaris Consortio. And in paragraphs 83 and 84 of that, he directly delves into this really tough issue of divorce and remarriage and things like, can divorced and remarried people receive the Eucharist? And so this is a magisterial document at the level of an apostolic exhortation that really very clearly provides a strong witness to the gospel truth, in both recognizing the humanity of the people involved and the dignity and sacredness of the Eucharist as well.
John, I really appreciate that call. That makes me very, very happy. I think that would have made Pope John Paul himself very, very happy to hear that. And it is one of the services that the Catholic Church can do when she's on her game is speak for not just for the special particular revelations, but also to the general moral problems that society gets itself into. So thank you. Joe, I'm very grateful that you came. I know you joined me in thanking the Lord wholeheartedly for the life and ministry of Pope John Paul II and in praying for his intercession for the whole world today on his feast day.
Amen. Buona festa, John Paul II.
Buona festa. I know what language that is. That's Italian. I'm going to add that to my Santo Subito. Now I got two Italian phrases.
There you go.
Now I need something for eat. Eat. I need someone. I got. What is there?
Manja,
anything?
Manja.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I already knew that one, Joe. All right. Coming up, game show. Carlo Broussard. Don't go anywhere. Get your pencils ready. Right after this, on Catholic Answers Live.